Oh, what's this? A breakfast taco from Taco Bell? What? Is that a waffle instead of a tortilla? Holy crap, I've got to try this!
Don't touch it! It's pure evil!
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome back to Junk Food Cinema, the show that traverses time and space to find those films that time forgot and few people have made space for on their DVD shelves. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, an entirely noisy manifestation, and I am joined by my friend and co-pilot across the schlock map, screenwriter slash novelist, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
It's pure evil.
Pure evil! It's evil!
Mom, you know, Dad, don't touch it. It's evil.
It's evil, don't touch it, actually, is the lie.
So Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as Stitcher if you want to hear more hilarity like that. We are also on the Twitters if you want to follow us at Junk Food Cinema. And you can like us on the Facebooks, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema.
On the Facebooks, you see.
On the Facebooks. For all you kids that are on them interwebs and whatnot. You know what's funny? Don't touch it, it's evil is one of those lines. There's several movie quotes throughout my life that I always thought were just things my dad said because it took me years to see the movies that they were associated with. So I just assumed things like, don't touch it, it's evil. And it's only an island if you look at it from the water. You'll get nothing and like it. Like all of these quotes from movies that I thought were just things my dad said. And then later I saw the movies and I was like, oh, okay, I get it now. Continuing our trek through the great sci-fi comedies, we shuffle through the time-space riff and arrive at Terry Gilliam's Time Bandits.
One of the greatest, absurdest children's films ever made.
Yes, and at points, one of the darkest children's films ever made.
Yeah.
Just a minute. What about the plot?
The what?
The plot. What the film is about.
This is a film about, if you haven't seen it, a group of heaven's engineers who grow tired of designing trees and shrubs.
Well, no, they get fired from designing trees and shrubs.
And they steal a map from God and become temporal traversing thieves, if I can use somewhat of alliteration there. So that's the basic premise of the movie. And then this kid gets involved as he is sort of accidentally a way station as they move through time looking for these artifacts to steal. And then he ends up going with them as they go to places like the Middle Ages. They go to King Agamemnon's court. They go to the Titanic. I mean, they're basically all over the place before they get to the realm of legends. And in the time of legends, that's when you have things like you have giant ogres and you have the evil one, who is
the prime evil.
He is played by David Warner. And I mean, that's one of the things you kind of have to talk about right off the bat. Is that this film has an amazing cast?
Oh yeah. Well, this is one of Terry Gilliam's early films.
Yeah, right after Jabberwocky, actually.
Right after Jabberwocky, but this was in the era right after Monty Python.
Mm-hmm.
Monty Python had broken up, and but they were all still working together and doing things, mm-hmm. and they weren't together as Python specifically. They were still doing some of those things together, but they would go off and they would all, a handful of them would get together, but you weren't allowed to call it a Monty Python thing.
Right.
So that was the basic rule, was when it wasn't all of you, you weren't Monty Python. So this was a Monty Python movie that wasn't a Monty Python movie. And so you've got Terry Gilliam writing a movie with Michael Palin,
mm-hmm.
That also has John Cleese show up.
Yeah.
So, and it is, and it is just a fantastically weird, bizarre, strange little mindfuck of a kid's movie. Because the thing is while all of that is true in your description, what the movie's really about is it's about this kid who's neglected by his parents. His parents are these two
waspy.
Yeah, very waspy. They are very much keeping up with the Joneses, television obsessed. gadget obsessed people, which is then reflected in evil. You know, David Warner's evil is technology obsessed.
When I have the map, I will be free and the world will be different because I have understanding.
Understanding of what, Master?
Digital watches. And soon I shall have understanding of video cassette recorders and car telephones. And when I have understanding of them, I shall have understanding of computers. And when I have understanding of computers, I shall be the supreme being.
Who is very much, a deliberate reflection of what is keeping this boy's parents from being interested in him. And he's a kid who's interested in history, and he's interested in the outside world, and he's very excited about it all, and his parents aren't interested in talking to him at all.
Terry Gilliam, as film critic Robert Sellers put it, is very interested in the pin pusher's utopia. He's very interested in this very sort of middle class, but almost constrictively middle class environment. And from that, we get these parents who very much epitomize that. And we get this child who, you know, with his exuberance and his innocence, is sort of like trying to break away from that and not finding the ability to in his everyday life. And then into it comes this this team of little people who, like I said, used to work for heaven. They literally were designing shrubs and trees. And they decided that they instead were going to steal this map and go all throughout time stealing things from Napoleon, stealing things from, like I said, Agamemnon, who, by the way, in the script, in the original draft of the script, Terry Gilliam wrote, the warrior, he wrote this of Agamemnon in this scene. The warrior takes off his helmet, revealing someone that looks exactly like Sean Connery or an actor of equal but cheaper stature. That was in the original script.
That sounds exactly like a Michael Palin, Terry Gilliam joke.
And then Sean Connery reads that, loves it, and opts to play the role.
Yeah.
They had him for a very short time, but he's like, well, I'm Sean Connery. I guess I'll be the Sean Connery type. Who plays Agamemnon? You got Ian Holm as Napoleon. Mentioned John Cleese as Robin Hood. Michael Palin and Shelley Duvall play this weird couple that keeps showing up in various time periods.
Yep.
So yeah, it's in a really great cast. But like we were saying before, it's a very strange movie, and it was early in Terry Gilliam's career. And what had happened was he wanted to make Brazil, and he was trying to sell this guy named Dennis O'Brien, who was one of the two guys at Handmade Films. Handmade Films was a company started by ex-Beatle George Harrison specifically to get the movie Life of Brian made. So this is a studio whose first film was Life of Brian. So to say that George Harrison was a fan of Terry Gilliam was a little bit of an understatement. So you have Terry Gilliam trying to sell Dennis O'Brien, the other person at Handmade Films, on Brazil. He really wants to make this movie called Brazil, but he just can't get him excited about it. So he's like, okay, fine, I'll make a family movie that I know will sell, and we'll do that first. And that is where Time Bandits comes from. And that's why we get Time Bandits before 1980 or before Brazil. And that's why there are some elements of Time Bandits that actually do show up in Brazil, the cages specifically, in the Time of Legends, where the evil ones lair and all that. But I think that's really interesting that it was like, this was almost a concession film by Terry Gilliam, like, fine, I will make this movie, and that will basically prove that I can make a marketable film, and then we will make Brazil. Because as we mentioned before, this is a really dark, type of children's film. I mean, you look at the ending alone. I mean, if you haven't seen Time Bandits, this is the point where you don't listen anymore, because I'm going to talk about the ending for a second. The kid's parents just explode. They're just gone. And then, like, the black comedy moment is when the fireman turns around and just gives him a wink and gets on the fire truck and drives away. And that's the end of the film.
It is. But at the same time, it's a dark ending with the promise of a happy ending. And ultimately, it's a great journey. The thing is at its core, what this movie is about is it's all about a smart, brilliant young kid born to very mundane parents, eventually realizing that he doesn't have to live their life. And that's what the entire movie's about. And while it is a fantasy movie, it is quite possibly a fantasy in the child's own head. And that you mentioned the fireman, you know, Sean Connery, that is the promise of the father that he always dreamed of.
Then also drives away.
Well, yes, no, he drives away, but the fact that he winks is kind of, you know, there's a certain promise to that, that he's not really being left alone in this world, that Agamemnon is still there looking out for him. It's happy in a Terry Gilliam sort of way. I mean, in that it's completely fucked up. But that entire ending is all about, you know, in fact, the entire third act is all a fantasy. And it can be argued that it's a fantasy inside this child's head, because, you know, we're in this fortress of pure evil that is built out of Legos, giant Legos, and, has a giant battle with evil that is done with all of the little plastic toys that a boy in 1980 would have had around his room. It's, you know, the Roman archers and the cowboys on horseback and the knights on horseback and the strange little toy of a spaceship with a laser on the front. And there's that shot at the end when everything's smoking and and you think the house is burning down, and he goes and he steps on this checkerboard, which has all these pieces on it that look like the castle. And that this is all something that was, quite possibly in this boy's head.
Well, I mean, you can extrapolate it back even further than the last third of the movie,
yes,
because every realm that he goes to in the beginning of the film, if you look in his bedroom, all around that room are basically signposts for the various time periods that he's going to visit.
Yeah, the knight that visits him at the very beginning, we see that picture on his wall of that knight in that setting.
Yeah.
And yeah, all of that stuff. He's talking about Agamemnon earlier. In fact, he's not called Agamemnon in the past. We just know he's Agamemnon because we've been told he's Agamemnon early on with when he's reading history. And so, yeah, no, this is a movie that works as a really great fantasy, but on a very adult level, on a very intellectual level, it's Terry Gilliam talking about the struggle of an intelligent child against mundane parents.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a great book called Very Naughty Boys, The Amazing True Story of Handmade Films. It was actually written by Robert Sellers. And in that book, he talks about how what Gilliam wanted to do with Time Bandits is he wanted to make a fairy tale, but he wanted to make a fairy tale that echoed the darker themes of the original Grimm's Brothers fairy tales. Or as Sellers puts it, he wanted to make a kid's film with fangs. And I feel like that's kind of... that's part of that ending as well. I mean, but there's bleak stuff throughout that entire movie.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the first era they go to, the first time period they travel to is Napoleon trying to conquer Italy. And we just watch, like, I think it's like 8 to 16 people get executed by firing squad.
Yeah.
And it's just in the background. That's just a set dressing.
And then we find out what's Napoleon doing. Napoleon is sitting, he's bored with the war.
Yeah.
And he's watching a Punch and Judy show.
Right.
And waiting, you know, wanting to see something else that entertains him. And this guy who is hoping not to be executed and is this close from killing himself.
Yeah.
Because everything he has doesn't appeal to Napoleon's obsession with his height.
Yeah. It's a literal Napoleonic complex, and it's communicated in such a fun way because he is only interested in – I mean, first of all, this is – if you watch Gilliam films a lot, this is a character – this is a signature that he puts in almost every film where there is sort of a performance within the movie where you have people who are like watching plays within a play or a performance within the film. I mean Baron von Munchausen is basically an entire film about that.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's something he comes back to with Parnassus too. But anyway, but Napoleon is only interested in the performers that are 4 feet tall and shorter. And when his generals come up to give him news, he gets really incensed. He's like, "Stop standing next to me. I feel like I'm in a bloody well because they're so much taller than he is." And they do such a great – and it's Ian Holm, who himself has played a hobbit.
Yeah.
So not a far cry from a short man himself. And I love that about it. But at the same time, like you said, like there's a guy who's trying to kill himself so he won't be executed. And then we watch people get executed by firing squad. This is the opening of the film.
Now, arguably, this was, you know, this was made, this was 1980, wasn't it?
1981.
Mm-hmm. this was a period of time where kids' films could be dark.
Sure.
And there, we had a number of dark films. Kids' films could be depressing. I remember growing up and watching The Velveteen Fucking Rabbit.
Fuck that movie.
Oh, my God. The Velveteen Rabbit, in which,
you know, and The Last Unicorn can go live on the island of misfit kids' films.
Yeah, well, except these misfit kids' films. This is what all the kids' films were like, you know? Old Yeller, for fuck's sake.
No, nope, won't watch it.
You know, I mean, this is, this era, this fit right in.
Spoiler alert, Old Yeller is very sad.
It fit in for that era. And in fact, we nerfed kids' films and we don't treat kids with the adult care that we used to.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get films like The Dark Crystal or Time Bandits or any of that kind of fucked up stuff. I mean, Raiders of the Lost Ark was a kids' film, for fuck's sake. And that was, we got the argument that why we got PG-13 as a rating was because Steven Spielberg wanted to rip a person's heart out in a PG-13 movie and
in a kids movie.
And we needed a way to a line of demarcation. We needed, you know, to delineate what was children's fare and what was preteen fare.
And thus tweens were born.
And thus we had a whole new group to market to. And thus we started nerfing kids films. And if you go back and show kids movies like this today, I honestly think if you raise kids with movies like this, you know, they turn out fine. They turn out like us. And we're normal, upstanding individuals.
Awful people.
But yeah, it's the nerfing of our culture has made us look back at films like this, like, holy fuck, what were we thinking? As if we were like, here, kids, why don't you go outside and play with these loaded handguns in traffic? When really it's like, here, kids, let's watch some children's films that you're going to enjoy. That's going to show you that life is kind of dark and fucked up.
Go play with these loaded metaphors.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's one of my favorite things about Time Bandits, I think, is how much it does actually mock religion in a way that's almost, it's funny because it does it in a way that's not even really that incendiary.
No.
And it's such an impossible feat to pull off, but like, he openly makes fun of religion. Like, there's a point where the supreme being says something like,
I mustn't waste any more time. They'll think I've lost control again and put it all down to evolution.
How do you get away with a line like that? How do you get away with just pointing your finger and laughing at organized religion?
We stole it from the supreme being. You mean God? What? We
don't know him that well.
The movie has lots of those little wonderful jokes. My favorite joke dealing with the supreme being is there at the end when he's like, I think evil turned out pretty well. You know, you think it turned out well. Yeah. You know, and then he asks why there has to be evil. I think it has to do with free will or something. It's just the idea of this bumbling God and his bump. Because essentially, and this is the thing, this is why I corrected you early on, was, you know, these guys are, you know, heaven's workmen. Essentially, these are angels.
Right.
These midgets are angels. And
Definitely going against the paradigm of angelic figures that we have seen in, you know, classic Renaissance art and all that other
stuff. But they're bumbling angels. They ended up creating some 600-foot tree that smells like garbage. And
they're bumbling angels who, the first chance they get, decide they want to be master criminals.
Well, no, they get demoted to this terrible job. And while they're doing the terrible job, they get access to the map. And they're like, hey, I've got an idea. Let's steal this map and go through history and steal all the best stuff.
Yeah.
And so then they go on this bumbling adventure, through this child's imagination.
Yeah.
But all the aspects of religion, it's never, because the thing is he's never actually called God. He's the supreme being.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so, they don't deliberately address any established religion. And so they didn't have the Life of Brian problem. In which they were deliberately kind of mocking a specific religion, but not so much mocking a religion as they were mocking the religious.
Well, I also love the scene where the evil one is standing around with his advisors and is saying something to the effect of like, this God never really created anything worthwhile. And one of them brings up the point where like, well, he created you. And he, of course, just makes him explode, because that's how people in the religious right deal with those kind of like could God microwave a burrito so hot he could not eat it kind of conundrums is that they just lash out.
But the except that the brilliance of that is that we then later find out that all of these things are suffering and they want to die, but not in a, but in a way that death is a reward, like a reward they're looking forward to. And so when you go back and rewatch that scene, he makes him blow up, not because he's pissed at him per se, but because he's just complimented him so he gets a reward. And so he's like, he gives him the thing that he really wants. I'm going to blow you up. And it's Gilliam's, it's our first real peer into just how warped and decidedly awesome Gilliam's fucked up logic is.
Yeah. And it's funny because I'm not the world's biggest Gilliam fan. Like I really, really like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. But I'm not even that big a fan of Brazil. Like, I completely respect how imaginative and how subversive Gilliam is. But there are points for me where I think he kind of lets his imagination run wild at the expense of an enjoyable narrative. For me, that's how I, like, you know, sitting and watching Brazil, I'm like, this is a wildly imaginative film. It's, you know, it's got great themes, and I really enjoy, you know, what he has to say, but I'm just like, I keep getting pulled out of the story every time he takes another diversion into like, oh, now I want to explore this idea I had. This dream I had looked like this, and this one looked like this. And I feel like the reason I like Time Bandits so much is that it is structured in such a way where they are traveling to different pockets of time and different areas and different venues. So he has the ability to kind of switch gears without it feeling like it's really derailing anything.
And I, on the other hand, would like to apologize to the audience as this is going to be the last of the Junk Food Cinemas as I beat you to death with a halibut. No. I totally understand. Gilliam is an acquired taste and not, and I don't mean that in an elitist sort of way, but in a, you know, he either makes films for you or he doesn't. And he makes them for me.
And
for the most part, except for Tideland. Tideland is where...
No, that one I haven't seen.
And Jabberwocky I'm not in love with either. I think Jabberwocky has its moments, but that ultimately this is the first, that Time Bandits is the first true Gilliam film. Mm. And Time Bandits is the first great Gilliam film. And I've enjoyed almost everything else ever since. I even love Baron Munchausen. I adore Dr. Parnassus. I love Zero Theorem. I think Zero Theorem's brilliant. But this is his great children's film.
Mm-hmm.
And he follows that up with Baron Munchausen, which is his great pining for childhood film. Which I think these two bookend very nicely.
Well, not only together. That, but Munchausen, what's interesting about that is it's almost his personal letter to either the critical community or audiences at large. Because Munchausen is a character who's not understood or embraced by the people that he thinks should be embracing him. And I feel like that's just Gilliam saying, like, why don't you people like what I do? Which, again, goes back to the performance within the performance kind of thing. And it's literally, I feel like that movie is Gilliam going, I don't understand what you don't like about my movies. And I feel like that's, you know, when you look at what happened with Brazil, like, there's so much of like a personal, it's not angst. It's not really angst, but there is like a personal sort of declaration in Baron Munchausen that's very much just like, this is what, like, you have basically people in the audience of that film saying, like, these stories are no good. As a storyteller, you're no good. And you're like, this is a very personal message. This is a very personal film for him. But again, we're talking about Time Bandits, and I keep going off on tangents.
Well, forget that film. We're on about our films.
Yeah, well, no, but they're important tangents because, you know, Gilliam doesn't make movies that aren't about something. He doesn't make movies where he isn't trying to say something through all this. I don't think he does. He's not like some directors who are weird for the sake of being weird. He's a director who has something that he wants to say at any given point. And Time Bandits is very much a film about that struggle as well. I surmise, and I don't know for sure, but the film reads to me like it's him dealing with the fact that his parents never understood him and about what it was like to be such a creative, inventive child, such a creative, inventive individual that the rest of the world did not get, that other people just did not embrace who Gilliam was, that he was this kid with dreams and thought big and was fascinated by the world. And when you watch, was it called Man from La Mancha? What's the name of the documentary?
Oh,
Lost,
yeah,
in La Mancha.
Lost in La Mancha.
When you watch Lost in La Mancha, one of the most fascinating things about the thing that you fall in love with Gilliam is just the childlike eyes that he looks at everything, and he's always so fascinated and in love with the world, and he just wants to celebrate life and make art, and there's not an angry bone in his body. He just wants to go out and celebrate how awesome everything is. And what was it like being that child trapped with that imagination in, you know, in the 1950s and the 1960s and in this era where people were fascinated by technology and the rise of technology, and it was all of it, we began, you know, very much keeping up with the Joneses with this, you know, the growing economy that we all of a sudden could afford to keep up with the Joneses. And I feel like that this film is very much his grand thesis on what it was like to struggle with that, and juxtaposing it and putting it in a very 80s sort of way.
And I would also surmise that he probably grew up in a home that was fairly religious, like maybe not ardently religious, but definitely practicing, because there, you know, and again, what's crazy about this is if he has these themes of being a misunderstood child, if he has these themes about taking pot shots at religion, which he clearly does throughout the movie, all of this is housed within a film that he made as a film he thought he could sell. So this is arguably the most commercial Gilliam gets, because this is a film that he literally made to go, I can sell a film so I can make my other film.
Yeah.
This is what happens when Gilliam, quote unquote, sells out. And it's still the most imaginative, wildly subversive and weird kids movie, you know, of the early 80s.
Yeah.
And it's his, like, I could just make a movie to sell a movie. That is how creative and imaginative I feel like he is. And he definitely has a lot to say, because even when he makes films that are, you know, I'm just going to do this because it'll be commercially successful, it's still Time Bandits.
Yeah.
There are so many filmmakers that cannot boast making a film as good as Time Bandits at their best, and this is arguably Gilliam just almost as like a passing thought or a back burner project just to get some clout together so that he could make his opus with Brazil. And that's fascinating to me.
And speaking of tying a couple of these elements together, and going back a few weeks to Buckaroo Banzai.
Yes.
What this and Buckaroo Banzai have in common are incredibly, undeniably catchy final songs and great credit sequences. and we talked about handmade films. George Harrison writes this catchy as fuck song.
Yeah.
Like I this was one of those movies my wife and I sat down. We crammed all three of these movies into one night, because we were running up against a trip that I had to London. So we watched all these movies, and she had seen this movie, but she had not seen it since she was a child and didn't remember much from it. So she's watching this whole movie going, holy crap, this is fucked up. I love it. This is great. And then I kept talking about how I couldn't wait to get to the end credits, because the end credits are this really cool, you know, series of photos from the film set to this great George Harrison song. And I'm like, the George Harrison song is so catchy. She's like, I don't remember it. And then the first notes go up and she goes, oh my God, I remember this song. I love this song.
Yeah. So let's look at the lyrics. And then I'm going to tell you a little story about how this song came to be.
About how got flipped, turned upside down.
Listen to these lyrics here for a second, and then we're going to come back to them. Greedy feeling, wheeling, dealing, losing what you've won. See the dream come undone. All you owe is apologies. Okay. Here's the thing. Gilliam, for all of his sort of breathtaking imagination and visual styling, wasn't the easiest guy to work with, as it turns out. And part of the thing that's so incredible about Time Bandits is that at so many points, it could have been shut down entirely. So he decides to make Time Bandits as like, I'm going to make this film, it'll be profitable, it'll be marketable, and then I can go on and make
Brazil.
Well, turns out that people in Hollywood, they went to Hollywood first, so Handmade Films is behind it, they're going to go to Hollywood to get the money to make it, and everyone in Hollywood at the time was basically like, who the hell is Terry Gilliam? So they can't get anyone to back the movie, so George Harrison and Handmade Films decides they're going to put up all the money. It's about £5 million, and they had to mortgage their office. Like, they basically had to put put another mortgage on their office in order to get the money to get the film made. So they were really putting all their eggs into this basket. And then from that point forward, and this is all, like, seriously, if Very Naughty Boys, The Amazing True Story of Handmade Films, where Robert Sellers explains all of this. They wrote the script. Palin and Gilliam basically wrote the script in a month because Michael Palin had something else he was working on. So Gilliam proceeds to fight with the other Handmade studio head, Dennis O'Brien, on basically everything. And one of the things that they found the most acrimony over was, in fact, the ending, which O'Brien thought was too extreme. And at one point, it got so acrimonious that Gilliam grabbed the film reel and a nail and put the nail up against the film reel and was like, I made this, I can destroy it. I'll just run this nail right down the middle of the film reel and destroy it. So, like, it got really heated. And eventually, even George Harrison, who, like we said, was a huge fan of Gilliam's, told him that he was like working with John Lennon all over again because he was so stubborn and would never compromise, which Gilliam took as a huge compliment, by the way.
Yeah, well, I mean, come on, talk about all the cards to play.
Yeah.
Like you know, you're just like working with John Lennon. It's like, well, I'm both complimented and insulted at the same time. That's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and especially since Gilliam came from the Beatles of comedy.
Yes.
You know, Monty Python. You know, it's very hard to find a better pedigree than that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's one of the things I've always found amazing is, you know, one of these members of what's considered to be one of the greatest rock bands of all time and one of the members of what is considered to be one of the greatest comedy troupes of all time. Working together to make a movie.
Yeah.
So the song.
So one of the other things that Gilliam had a problem with is that George Harrison wrote a number of songs that were supposed to be peppered throughout the movie. And he felt like they were too plucky and upbeat and really kind of undermined the overall tone. So he just starts striking them out. No, 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 no. But he does kind of make the concession. And it's such a backhanded concession. Like, you can do the end credits song. Basically, it's going to be the only song in the movie. And so if you listen to the lyrics of that song, it's like, yes, it's a very memorable song, fraught with lyrics that is basically George Harrison telling Terry Gilliam to go fuck himself. I'm going to read these lyrics one more time. Greedy feeling, wheeling, dealing, losing what you won. See the dream, come undone. All you owe is apologies. He's singing directly to Terry Gilliam. So we all remember that song as being like, oh, it's a really sweet song. Oh, it's a really memorable song. It's so great. And as it turns out, was basically a studio executive / ex-Beatle telling film director / ex-Monty Python troupe member to go fuck himself. That story always makes me laugh.
But because he's a Beatle, it's catchy as fuck.
It's catchy as fuck.
I got my mind set on you. I got my mind set on you. That was supposed to be in the – no, it wasn't. But that'd be kind of amazing if I really want this song in the movie.
This song is just six words long. This song is just six words long. This is why we don't have a music podcast. And by that, I mean a podcast where we sing. But yeah, so that – all of these various troubles, all of the acrimony he had with basically the only studio who believed in him at that time, this is how unwavering Terry Gilliam is when it comes to his vision. The only studio that was willing to back him at the time was willing to leverage everything they had to support him, and he still would not compromise. And I feel like – and I'm not trying to slight Terry Gilliam. I'm not trying to say he's a bastard. I'm saying this was Terry Gilliam. He was stubborn. He was, like I said, unwavering. He had a vision, and there was no one on the planet who was going to make him compromise.
Well, and when you watch Lost in La Mancha, you see that's absolutely who he is.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't help but think it's the fact – it's two factors. One, he's an absolute genius. I mean, he's brilliant. He is indecipherable to most people. He is just,
except for other geniuses. Is that a knock on me not liking Gilliam?
No, come on. No, not at all. No, they say, they say that talent is hitting the target that's set before you and genius is hitting the target that nobody sees. Hmm. And Gilliam has hit that target so many times and he's always looking for that target and he's always firing and sometimes he doesn't hit, but he's always looking for that target. So he's got this genius and then at the same time, he's got this massive, massive success. from Monty Python. You know, they were the, you know, best known, funniest guys in the world. Everyone's been ripping them off ever since. You know, we wouldn't have Saturday Night Live if it weren't for Monty Python's Flying Circus. He, you know, directed so much of that, you know, so much. He was very much one of the behind the scenes guys who appeared in a bunch of the stuff, but was doing a lot of the technical putting together the stuff. Of course, was doing the infamous animations for all that. And when you have success plus genius, you get obstinance. And you get people who just kind of put their foot down and go, no, you don't understand because you are not creative enough to see this. And you are a Beatle, for fuck's sake. You are, you know, when I have a question about music, I'm going to turn to you because you fucking know, because you've been in the shit with John Lennon. You've seen John Lennon naked, for fuck's sake. You know, and I can only talk about John Cleese naked. And but you get to that, you get that level of obstinance, and you see that throughout, you know, Lost in La Mancha, you know, and it's not in a bad way. He's not in a deliberately arrogant way, not in like what you see from studio suits who have to throw their weight around. It's in a way that he just feels like he sees something that you don't see, and he's going to keep fighting you until you see it. Right. Because once you see it, you'll understand that dark ending is exactly why Time Bandits is brilliant and not something to be afraid of. And so that is very much, that is just, you see that all over all of his work. And that's why his work is so distinctive, but also why he has a hard time finding an audience, why he had such a hard time finding distribution for Zero Theorem. I mean, Drafthouse Films ended up picking it up, which I thought was awesome. Drafthouse Films has an amazing slate coming out, and it's of all these really crazy films that other people don't get. But, you know, people were just, I feel like people look at Gilliam as, we don't get this, we don't understand it. It's kind of brilliant, and people think it's brilliant, but he doesn't sell movies because he's doing his own thing.
Well, I just realized that puts Tim League in the same company as George Harrison, as people who have distributed Terry Gilliam movies.
Yeah.
And that's kind of amazing.
That is kind of amazing.
And I also didn't know this. Apparently in the late 90s, Gilliam was preparing a sequel for Time Bandits. He was putting together a sequel that was going to bring back most of the original cast, with the exceptions of David Rappaport and Tiny Ross, two of the main characters who had passed away a few years before.
Because they were older in the movie.
Yeah. And then Jack Purvis had been paralyzed in a car accident, so they were basically going to write him in as having been paralyzed. But then when he also passed away is when he finally scrapped it. When he lost three of his Time Bandits, that's when he decided, you know, I'm not going to do it. But it is surprising to me that he and it was Charles McGowan who were putting together a script for Time Bandits 2. And I don't really feel like Time Bandits is a movie that needs a sequel by any stretch of the imagination, but at the same time, I want to see Terry Gilliam stretch his imagination and show us how many other, you know, realms and how many other time periods they could travel to. And
well, and if you're bringing back the original cast, I mean, you're talking about the kid who was at that point, you know, a young Gen Xer.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that young Gen Xer, you know, who's at that point in his early 20s, what does that guy do in time?
Well,
that's an interesting question.
Well, not only that, but it's like the movie is specifically about traveling through time. So characters getting older, not really a big problem. In fact, kind of plays into the nature of the narrative. Kind of plays into the fact that they are, you know, seeing people at different times, and they are kind of like it's such a central point of the film. So I feel like there's plenty of interesting things that Gilliam could have done with that. But I'm probably
Sean Connery was still acting at that point,
yeah.
So he could have he definitely could have reprised the role as Agamemnon or the firefighter.
Yeah, that's true. And I could speculate more as to what that film would have been about, but that would just be me shooting at targets I can't even see. So
I kind of want to read that script. If
right.
There's a script.
Yeah.
Because I never realized that. I never knew that he was thinking about Time Bandits 2. Like if there was, you know, I know a lot of people are excited about Goonies 2, but if there was a sequel to a kid's film from that era, it would be Time Bandits that I would have wanted to see.
Yeah. Return the map. Well, that's going to do it for our show. But of course, before we go, we have to talk about the junk food pairing for this week's film. And I know it's a little on the nose, but bear with me on this. For this particular movie, for Time Bandits, 1981 from Terry Gilliam, I am going to go with the classic French pastry, the Napoleon. Yes, Napoleon is in fact a character in the film and someone that they cross paths with in the film. However, Napoleon is also a very layered pastry. If you've ever seen one, it's like layer upon layer of there's like flaky goodness, and then there's icing, and then there's cream filling. It is a dessert of great substance. And though you may look at it and think, oh, it's just another cake, it actually is incredibly layered, incredibly dense, and full of surprising cream filling. So I kind of feel like when you watch Time Bandits, or if you watch the trailers for Terry Gilliam films, in my opinion, are notorious for mis-selling them. And I feel like if you...
Zero Theorem, you mean?
If you watch the trailer for Time Bandits, you may think, oh, this is just another 80s fantasy film. When it turns out, there's a lot of layers to it. There's a lot of terrific substance to it. And kind of reminds me of a Napoleon. So that is the connection that I have kind of forced upon us in the 11th hour.
I thought you were going with small fries.
No, that's an even more obvious joke, and I'm only, well, I'm not better than that at all.
You're not better than that.
No. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. I want to remind you once again that you can find Junk Food Cinema on iTunes and on Stitcher, as well as you can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And we will have a link for Time Bandits right here on the page at Film School Rejects. If you click on that icon and you buy that movie, or if you just click on that icon to get to Amazon and buy something else, we will get a portion of that purchase, and that really does support us, and we thank you very much for doing that. Cargill, where can people find you online?
You can find me at twitter.com/massaworm, that's MASSAWYRM, or at facebook.com/CRobertCargill. You can also find my books wherever you buy your books.
Wherever they keep those book things.
Dreams and Shadows, Queen in the Dark Things. And if you're in the Chicago area, keep your eyes peeled for we're shooting Sinister 2. So that's where I'm going to be around. So.
Cargill's third book. I understand Gilliam, and therefore I am better than you. A film writer's opus.
That's a terrible title. Just because that's the theme of the book doesn't mean that that's the title.
You don't want to hit him over the head with it.
No, no, no. The title is Brian is fucking wrong again. I'm playing around with that because it's such a good concept. I'm thinking about writing a sequel and having the first one being Brian is fucking wrong, and then the second one being Brian is fucking wrong again, and then you can go with Brian is still fucking wrong.
Yeah.
Son of Brian is still fucking wrong. You can just go on and on because you're always fucking wrong.
Beneath the Planet of the Brian is fucking wrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you're the Al Franken of film critics. Congratulations with those book titles. Jesus Christ. Well, you can find me online at Brian Guy Salisbury on the Twitters, on Facebook, facebook.com/Brian Salisbury, or you can find me over at oneofus.net doing some podcasts, writing some articles, continuing to be gloriously wrong, apparently, and having a great time with it. But yeah, that's going to do it for this week. So for Cargill, this is Brian reminding you
that Brian is still fucking wrong.
I'm just going to end on that. That's fine.